And yet there were people in Greece, even in those days, that had climbed Olympus and knew there wasn't anybody on top. So you have another dimension coming in here. The gods not only dwelt there, but they dwelt in some invisible dimension. They were not just physical beings. They were beings that had greater powers, greater extensions of consciousness and understanding. Then, after a long period of time, these gods that had moved so very, very far away began to move closer again. And ultimately, all religions came to the same conclusion, namely that the divine power upon which man must depend for his survival is not under the hearthstone or in the ancestral grave, nor is it in the far and distant reaches of the sky on some Olympian height. This God is in ourselves. And in every people, this concept gradually turned and moved back again into man. Such a panorama is interesting and fascinating and well within the field of anthropology, because that is where the rise of the God concept in nature has its strongest research programs. However, we must go back to our main theme now, namely that man was created by some kind of spiritual being, that man was the progeny of gods, or the production of powers superior to himself of some kind. The Greeks, being essentially naturalistic, were not, however, completely willing to assume that man was begotten by a particular and special act of deity. This was not originally their concept. Their concept, rather, was that there was a spiritual creation of man, that humanity began not as we know it in the cell or in the swamp or in the Elos, that man actually began as a splendid being in heaven. Among the mysteries of the Greeks, when they reached philosophic maturity, there was a very interesting speculation introduced that perhaps we should not forget, namely the reason why the gods are no longer on the top of Mount Olympus is because man is the gods. Now, this is an interesting thought, but you'll have to ponder it a little bit. Namely, that the great order of life moving into manifestation was not only created by the gods, but was the motion of the divine power itself into manifestation. Therefore, that the gods moved into their own creation, became immersed in it and absorbed in it, and that somewhere in the background of things, the great, splendid world of the gods sank into the darkness and mystery of matter, and in this way resulted finally in the emergence of life as seed everywhere because of the divine presence in matter, that this divine presence made all parts of matter full of life and capable of infinite growth from its own total substance. Dating on this, impossible. But theoretically thinking about these problems, we then have the second consideration, namely that something like the story of Deucalion and Pyrrha, namely that stones were thrown over their shoulders and that these stones became men and women. This is the second Greek concept of creation. The first creation was swept away by the deluge, and some of the old poets suspected that this deluge meant, in reality, the descent of the gods into the darkness of generation. That this is the great Ragnarok of the Nordic sagas, where Asgard and the great throne and the palace of Valhalla, all in flames and in combustion, fall into abyss together, at the dawn of human existence, carrying the Aces, the gods, into oblivion. That all that survived was a new world and a new peace, and two human beings to carry on the mystery of creation. So these legends are archetypal, they have some meaning, we know that. We know they are too splendid, too deep, too broad, and in the case of most of them, too strangely and deeply pathetic to have no meaning. They meant something. And part of the neglected field of our era, of our area, is to try to find out what they meant. If we have two creations, we can also go back to the Dionysiac legend, where the Titans, or the primordial elements of nature, manage to inveigle Dionysus, the young god, to follow them out into the sea of, and field of space. And when he was far from his divine home, they sat upon him, destroyed him, cooked his flesh, and ate him. But in the process of eating him, his head was saved by Minerva, or Athena, and taken back to Zeus. Zeus, discovering what had happened, threw his thunderbolts at the primordial giants, slew them, and from their ashes, containing the blood of his own divine son, he fashioned the bodies of men. Now this also is a very stimulating series of thoughts, for it also tells us that in some mysterious way, ancient man believed the human being to be a compound of the ashes of the Titans and the life blood of a god. And while we might say this was primitive egotism, we're not at all sure of it. We are more inclined to suspect that the same meanings that were later developed into great philosophical beauty by Plato are to be found in their simplest statements in these myths. Actually, then, the ancient people told us that what we call the creation of man resulted in the combination of two circumstances, one of which is traceable anthropologically and the other is not. The only other way it can be traced is by means of your great religious cycles of myths. And that these religious cycles were not outgrown, but were deeply and carefully considered, and from them elaborate structures of rational projection were fashioned about man. And these have never been disproved, although most of them have been broadly ignored, particularly within the last century. Of course, all of these structures were of much greater import prior to the rise of the Darwinian hypothesis. But now, to go on from this point, man created or brought into existence represents, therefore, a twofold motion of life. The positive motion of this life is from a divine source, called by the ancient Chaldeans the father fountains of the gods. From, therefore, the divine nature there descended the divine man. This divine man was truly and completely archetypal. Psychologically, we are not too sure of what is implied. We cannot be certain, but the tone, the general tone of this ancient thinking is that this divine man was the true anthropos, the true being, and that this being had walked with God. That this being had an existence in a divine world or a divine state. The ancients are not clear as to whether this divine state had been eternal or had risen from some previous state. But the general assumption actually is that divine powers, either created or generated, Or if we wish to go still further into this thinking, that these powers preserved in their own natures from previous unknown sources this essential being that is called man. Consequently, that man actually is the son of God. Not in the personal sense of an individual, but in the collective sense. For it is also specifically stated in the generation of man in several systems that in the creation, formation, or integration of this being, each of the principal deities contributed some essential characteristic or quality, as for example Athena, who bestowed the potential of wisdom, and Mercury, who bestowed the potential of learning or of knowledge. And each one of these deities bestowed from its own nature a quality. This immediately tells us something if we want to think about it for a moment, namely that the deities themselves are the personifications of qualities. Otherwise, they could not bestow them. That we are not dealing with persons, we are dealing with conditioned energies. And that these conditioned energies united, bestowing each its own quality upon the production of the anthropos, or a being, in which these qualities were therefore all latently present. This does not deny, however, that this being or this creature had great and enduring need for certain extensions of itself. In all systems, life, in order to manifest in any situation or condition, must adapt itself to form. Every life must be informed and end-formed. In order to exist in any environment or condition, a being must have an instrument, a body or a nature, composed of the substances of that environment or condition. Otherwise, it may be present, but it will be unseen and unknown if we wish to presume that it is present. This is true not only of the human being, but of the beings that very likely and most certainly do inhabit other planets, other solar systems, other cosmic systems. Whatever life comes into manifestation must clothe itself in the substances of its environment, and by so doing, make a bridge between its own subjective and the sphere in which it wishes or needs to function. The ancients had a simple example of this, and they made use of it. We know that the Indian people undoubtedly developed a large part of their great cosmological theory from embryology, from the actual study of the birth of the human being now. They believed they had a key to the great cyclic processes by which universal generation is achieved. This has also been obvious, noted, in many other systems of mythological thinking, as in Frazier's Golden Bough, where you will find many references to these parallel groups of legends. If, therefore, in the primordial nature of things, we are to have a being coming or entering into a state of form, we must also have form itself gradually moving. Everything moves, and the development of life implies the production of forms. In the great prehistoric Phoenician history, we have a record of this particular phase of the subject. Namely, that we have opposed, or at least polarized, to the great power of the divine beings who fashion the inward parts of things. We have another being that the ancients called nature. Now, nature to them was a little different from what we hold the word to mean today. Nature was a little more geological in their thinking than in ours. To us, nature is a rather beautiful panorama of sunrises, sunsets, and daisy fields. That was not the way the ancients thought of it. Always ensouling everything, making everything to live, which is part of his ancient way, to him nature was also a being. And if God was the father of all things, nature was the mother of all things. And everything that exists is a child of God and nature, a child of the primordial father-mother. Now nature was constructing continuously strange and beautiful and wonderful shapes and devisements. Nature, therefore, was spontaneously generating forms. Nature was hard at work with this monocellular organism coming out of the primordial ooze. Nature is full of life of itself. This life is not different from the life of God. It is merely an aspect of it. It is merely the opposite pole. It is the obscured or privated life of deity, according to the ancient legends. And therefore, nature was producing forms in which was a degree of life. This degree of life, as Sankaranayapan points out, however, was a comparatively humble degree of life. A life that might correspond with the prenatal growth of the human being, in which nature itself, as in the womb of Meru in the Indic myths, is generating a form which at some time is to be quickened or to be made alive. Thus, the embryo was made in nature. The life was made by the gods. And these two coming together represented the quickening or the union of these parts so that by the breathing of the breath of life into the dust of the earth, God fashioned man. Now, the more we think about it, the more we can get scientific on this theme, because it opens a tremendous vista of possibilities by which a great many concepts otherwise meaningless can be reconciled and ordered. The only thing necessary to give validity to this concept is something that is causing considerable stress and strain in modern education, namely the possibility of assuming that the ages have been in some measure right and that man is a living soul. This is the great bugaboo. This is the great unsolved mystery. If man is to be regarded as solely and totally the product of Mother Nature, with no help from a divine father, then we cannot follow this hypothesis successfully. But when we block it, we block so many things that perhaps it will pay us to pause and see whether the exclusion of what might be termed the religious solution actually helps us any, or whether it does not make the entire procedure less meaningful, less purposeful, and less understandable. And always assuming that nature's ways are orderly and that nature's ways are purposed, we have to begin to speculate as to what this order is and what these purposes might be. In any event, the greatest thinkers of all time, those to whom we are indebted for the greatest amount of knowledge that we possess, and for the foundations of every art and science that we now regard as essential to education and learning, these leaders, these pioneers of life, all agreed in the simple belief and conviction that man did have a soul. That this soul, or psychic nature, actually was not identical with his body, nor was it a byproduct of body, and that there is nothing essentially unreasonable in the conception that a quickening did take place. And that at some extremely remote period, this quickening brought together a condition or circumstance which accounts for what we call the beginning of the culture impulse, the culture instinct. It is quite possible, as the ancients pointed out, that the form of man reached a comparative state of maturity before this culture instinct set in upon him and began to change him. So let us now go around again, because we have to come back this road several times in different ways to get to our ultimate objective. And let us go now to consider for a moment this cultural problem. This problem upon which so much hangs and which has been so generally neglected as to its origin. What is the difference, for instance, in the state of man immediately before and after the advent of culture? It is assumed that man, having gained a certain differentiation from other animals or from other creatures, physically speaking, was confronted by a series of circumstances which had to be assailed and conquered before man could attain the level of culture. Some of these circumstances are entirely reminiscent of the present animal state in nature. That the beginning of it all was that man, physically speaking, must survive. That survival, the will to live, the expression of a gradually increasing ingenuity in the process of preserving his own survival, when analyzed, considered, and subjected to the modification of 1.5 billion years, accounts for the gradual rise of man. Actually, in the animal kingdom, the need for survival is obvious. And animal life is largely divided between two problems of survival: individual survival through food and collective survival through generation. These two become the principal purposes. Nature has, in many instances, indicated that of these two purposes, food is the servant of generation. In other words, there are many forms of life that, having reproduced, then perish. It being obvious that their continuance by the maintenance of food alone is not the primary purpose of nature. That in these ancient patterns, the purpose of nature was to ensure perpetuation, and that from that time on, the fate of the individual creature was far less meaningful. In the beginning, then, we have the animal man, or the animal type of man, distinguished by what has been called his parasite existence. It's coming back a little, but we hope we'll get over it. Namely, that man lived from nature without essentially contributing anything to nature. That man also lived merely by the continuous search for food. Therefore, by the continuous use of the available supplies of nature. This situation, going along, became an almost constant demand upon the primordial life of man. His existence was non-cultural, simply because at that stage existence and survival became so intimately associated. So in the first platform of our thinking, man's culture was blocked by survival. He had to consider only continuance and to make innumerable and continuous adjustments to the challenge of destruction which hung constantly over him. The second period, which has been considered to be the next prenatal step in the birth of man as a culture being was that which brought him to the beginning of his awareness of the possibility of attaining a certain partnership or a certain control, as it is called, over nature. This control is exemplified by ingenuity beginning to rise as a means of challenging the fatality of nature. It may have started with almost anything we can imagine, perhaps a rock in a man's hand. He found that he could throw a rock and achieve certain ends more easily than trying to fight the animal with his bare hands. He then learned to put a handle on the rock and made a rough stone axe out of it. In the course of this, he also discovered other things. Somewhere, that magnificent Promethean moment when he discovered fire. When he also discovered, as Diogenes tells us later, that a cup can be more convenient than your hand when you want a drink of water. That by degrees, man began to surround himself with the primitive necessity luxuries, which began to indicate the rise of his own basic pattern for survival. But he's still struggling to survive now a little more successfully. Undoubtedly, he was nomadic to a degree. Those who could not be nomadic had to adjust themselves to the seasonal world in which they lived, and some of these adjustments were pretty strenuous. In fact, many did not survive at all. Then comes the next important step. Man beginning to cultivate nature, to gain control. And one of the simplest and easiest ways he accomplished this was by learning agriculture. And the oldest gods of the Greeks were venerated and honored because they brought the agricultural mystery to man. The domestication of animals and the rise of agriculture made possible gradually the integrated living in a community. It was no longer necessary to wander to find new food supplies. It was possible to produce food where you wanted it, and not necessarily always when you wanted it, but in sufficient abundance so that parts of it could be stored against seasonal change and condition. Man began to gain a certain victory. In the course of this victory, he reached a point which we may call safety. Safety is always a relative thing. Safety meant more surviving than were lost. It did not mean total survival. Safety meant one thing, however, a break in the continuous demand of survival. It meant the possibility of the individual having available to him an increasing amount of leisure. His wants were few, his needs were not too many, but as soon as it became possible for him to make use of control of nature, he began to develop what might be termed leisure. Leisure, or freedom from the challenge of continual survival, permitted man to turn upon himself, not in the sense of war primarily, although this was one of the byproducts of undisciplined and unenlightened leisure, but rather turned upon himself to be able to sit still, to be quiet, to contemplate, to take his eye from the utter immediate and consider that which was somewhat more remote. Gradually out of the sense of leisure, out of the possibility of man having time to do something beside eat, propagate, and die, we see the beginnings of culture made possible to us. Now, this period we now reconstruct in this way. But there is another possible interpretation of this reconstruction procedure. following a little bit of what we have, obviously fulfilling it. But what we are really telling in this story of man's gradual victory over the prehistoric problem of survival is that man was constantly growing in some way. He was growing in resourcefulness. He was growing in skill. Perhaps he was growing in strength. More likely, he was growing in control, which is the thing that makes it possible with less strength to accomplish more. Thus, we finally have the story of a being growing up to a state of self-identity, growing up to a state which is the first peculiar evidence of humanity, and that is thoughtfulness. Up to this time, we can find man differing in some ways from the creatures around him, but with no certainty of victory over them, and no probability of a destiny apart from them. Suddenly, well, I say suddenly because it appears so in our frame of reference, but probably not in time so rapidly, man differentiated from all other forms of life around him. He suddenly began to assume a uniqueness. And this uniqueness was only possible when a certain degree of personal integration had been attained. The Greeks and other ancient peoples, working upon their mythological platforms, came to the conclusion that this growing up of bodies through the animal state finally resulted in the creation of a being in whose organism and integration the release of what might be termed an extra faculty was possible. This release of an extra faculty was not its dawn, was not its beginning in man, but according to these ancient peoples, it was at this time that the quickening took place, and that which had previously been a free soul became identified with this growing form, because this form had now reached a degree of growth in which the function of this being began to be possible. Certain centers of nervous structure, certain refinements in brain and in the various fields of the human sensitivity made it possible for something to take hold of this form, to possess it, to move in upon it, to ensoul it, and to begin to operate upon it from within, moving gradually and inevitably towards final conquest of this form. This would be perfectly in line with some of the basic thinking that we have, namely that what we might term evolution or cultural growth is therefore being controlling its own instrument, and that what we see around us as cultural progress is merely a byproduct, an inevitable consequence of a pattern of self-conquest occurring within the being. That civilization, therefore, is nothing more or less than a degree of progress attained in the essential psychic compound of man. That these ensouled beings gradually then moved by degrees over a long period of time through the processes of increasing control of these instruments which they possessed. This control affected slowly and inevitably every department of human function. The nearest parallel that we have to it in the visible natural progress of man is the process of childhood, the process of growing up after birth. We have here the clear and certain indication of consciousness, if we wish to so call it, gradually emerging from inadequate physical structure, and that the growth of the structure is important only that it leads or results in the growth or release of the consciousness within that structure. Thus, the growing child is the one who is gaining control of its body and is gradually transforming this body from a prison into a skillful instrument of its own purpose. This is one explanation for what we term the cultural program for man, that at the transitional stage, man ceased to be like other animals around him simply because he was ensouled by a being with greater potential, and that this ensoulment resulted in the purposes of the body being gradually modified to result in their final acceptance of the purposes of the being in the body. Thus, this new perspective gave man the incentive, gave man the dynamic by which he went forth to become a builder of cities, by which all the things that are related of him in the ancient works were made possible, and that what we now term evolution is the slow and gradual revelation of that which is inevitably the self, inevitably the anthropos, and that anthropology is therefore the study of the anthropos. And the anthropos, as the Egyptian gnosis tells us, was not the visible man, but the being above the man. Thus, in the Gnostic system of Valentinus, the being is called anthropos, and the body is called anthropos, the son of anthropos, a peculiar term with which scholars have been working for ages, trying to find out what was meant. Therefore, that the being is the man, and the body is that man which is the son of the man, or the extension of him, into manifestation. And that therefore, we have perhaps an understanding of the rise of a great anthropomorphism in human experience. That is the struggle of light and darkness, the struggle of good and evil, the struggle of life and death. For this struggle was more or less archetypally the struggle of the being against the stasis of the body. That the fall of man symbolically is the descent of the man into the body. To be captured, as Plato says, like the oyster within its shell. Therefore, that what we call evolution is divisible into two great parts. That which is called nature, which is forever the molder of forms, the creator of bodies, and that which is called man, who is eternally the inhabitant of these instruments or vessels which have been fashioned for his need. That this was purposed, that the gods of the Olympian heights decreed it to be this way, that life is a constant ascending of forms being met by the descending of life, and wherever these two meet, there is a living soul. That this living soul is not generated simply from the experience of contact in nature, but is the result of the union of two elements or two principles to form a compound. This again is consistent with the Pythagorean and Gnostic philosophies. For we are informed by these systems that there are three states in nature: spirit, matter, and form. Form is a compound. Form is a body which must be composed of material elements and archetypal energies. The reason why matter becomes formal is because it comes under the laws and rules of a pattern or archetype. And that this archetype bestows mathematical or geometrical harmony upon matter, raising matter into organization. And that such organization as is resulting from these two factors may be regarded as the proper definition of the ensouled man. Now we may say, what have we actually done on the level of our anthropological researches? We have not changed the fact that out of the amoeba, out of the clod, out of the marsh and the mire, there crawls something forth upon the earth. But we may question whether that thing which crawled forth upon the earth was actually the beginning of the total man. We may question whether this being, left entirely to its own devices, could ever have been anything than a superanimal. That it rose with others of its kind. That it developed with others of its kind. And as in the case of the embryo before birth, up to a certain point, the human embryo cannot be differentiated from the embryo of a chicken or a horse. But as a certain point is reached, then the one indicates gradually and inevitably that it is going to be a chicken. The other remains, continues to unfold, and finally becomes a human being. But at a certain state, they're indistinguishable. There is no way of telling one from the other, except that one grows more before it is born. And the one that grows more is man. Thus, in the face of nature, there is no way in which we could distinguish, or no certain method by which we could indicate a point in the remoteness of things where man and the animal could be clearly differentiated. This would follow again the most ancient thinking we have, namely that in that time there was no obvious difference, but that this difference appeared in due time, appeared when life reached the point of sustaining this difference, and that at that time this difference became manifested. And man suddenly became a creature with a purpose. A creature with a reason for existence other than biological. And that biology did not cease. Because the continuance of forms for embodiment continued to be necessary. That the search for food did not cease. Because this body, which was to be the house of a soul, had to be maintained and sustained, or the soul was homeless. However, life divided now into two purposes. One, to be regarded as the maintenance of the house, and the other, the increasing freedom of the householder, the being that lived in the house. This immediately divided the life of man into two purposes. Psychologically, these purposes are everywhere obvious. Man is not a united creature in his purposes. He is purposed by two contrary forces. And the conflict between these contrary forces is one of the principal reasons for nearly all the problems that arise in human life. The survival from a bodily standpoint is also sustained by something that we call instinct. Now, instinct is something we do not know too much about. It's one of those delightful things that we should know a lot about, and because we need to know, we cannot find out. But instinct seems to tell us, or our own study of instinct, that in this part of our nature, we have the survival of what has been called the pre-Adamite man, that is, the pre-ensouled man, that instinct was the power that governed before the quickening. that instinct, therefore, was a life out of nature, a kind of nature spirit that rose out of the earth and was that part of man's structure that did respond unhesitatingly and continuously to the demands of survival. That what we commonly believe to be instinct today is therefore the survival of a primordial pressure. And that instinct, after it has gone to school and gotten a diploma, instinct becomes sophisticated or cultivated to the degree that it may seem to be a legitimate force that has inherited the real right of ruling the body. Instinct, now not fully recognized in itself, can therefore be the cause of the most excessive positive and negative reactions of our emotional life, our vital life, and certain rudimentary elements of our mental lives. Thus, body left to itself follows instinct. Body and soul follows the soul. The instinct nature of man has slowly become considered under a broad general title, the lower man. Now, the lower man is a most agreeable fellow. The lower man is constantly impressing upon us the sovereign importance of doing what we please. The divine man is constantly impressing upon us the sovereign importance of doing that which is right, or that which is necessary, or that which is next. Each of these forces is seeking the gratification of itself, seeking also the fulfillment of its own purposes. Instinct has no over-purpose, because the primary creature seeking to eat ate and was hungry again, because it ate only the food of nature. But the soul man sought another food, that those who ate thereof should not again hunger. And this difference has carried on. It almost would seem, although this may be an exaggeration, and I wouldn't want to be quoted for this, but to the press at least, it would almost seem that what we term materialism is instinct with a college education. That materialism is essentially the aggrandizement of the man of instinct, on the assumption that this man, by piling mountain upon mountain, piling Osir upon Pelion, and piling them both upon Olympus, that he is going to reach heaven. That the instinct man is going to be able to in some wonderful manner usurp the prerogatives of the soul man, and thereby gain an immortality or a survival apart from soul. This was a great subject of drama, out of myth and of legend. But the pattern of it is so rather obvious in our daily living that it perhaps is worth a little careful consideration. That we have, as Goethe says in Faust, two beings within us. One in the earth aspires, the other to heaven aspires. And these are the two men, Anthropos and Anthropos, the son of Anthropos. And it was by giving man this inward insight of the soul nature that the powers, personal or impersonal, universal or inevitable, however we wish to so calculate them or define them, having breathed into man the breath of life, made him master of his garden, and gave him dominion over the creatures of the air and of the fields. Now, in giving him dominion, the ancients would say that first of all, they bestowed upon man potential dominion over himself. But that this dominion had to be earned. and that this earning was nothing more or less than integrated yearning. That it was yearning backed by purpose, backed by energy. So that these things which man instinctively longed to fulfill might be fulfilled. Culture has been defined as man's longing for truth, longing for total internal maturity. And that this internal maturity is the result of a kind of second birth. That by the first birth, man was born out of the water and the mud. But by a second birth, the Son of Heaven was born in man. And having taken up its abode in man, becomes by natural right the proper ruler of man. Therefore, that man must be ruled by this psychic integration, or the self within the body. As a support of this concept, we also have the continuous evidence that man advances most, becomes most certainly secure, when he depends upon the superior phases of his consciousness for his protection and his survival. Man is no longer capable even of thinking of entering into a heavily competitive relationship with the inferior forms of life around him. He is no longer of them. He sees them no longer as like himself. Rather, he perceives that his survival, his security, rests in a battle within his own nature. Therefore, we have a new heaven and a new earth. That new heaven and the new earth, which for man become infinitely more important than the vast heaven and earth of which he is biologically and psychologically a part. That this new heaven is his own inward life, and his new earth is the world into which this life has been placed. That there is therefore the heaven in man and the earth which is the outer part of man. And the great processes which we now call evolution, arise from not the pressure of incident and accident upon the outer life of man, but the pressure of an inner life to express itself through man. This pressure becomes then the irresistible and inevitable force that has driven man down through the ages, causing him to become ever more concerned with self-knowing, and ever more concerned with not only adjustment to the world, which might presumably be even achieved by instinct, but of a reformation of the world, of a restoration of a better state, and the envisioning of a way of life superior to that which presently exists. These things arise not from experience because man has not known them. The world we look for is not a world that comes to us from our physical environment, but rather is archetypal of a universal state which preceded our involvement in a material existence. Thus we can assume a parallel, the possibility that anthropology as we know it is not essentially in error, but rather that it is half of a story, and that the other half of the story takes part or takes place behind the line or the veil which divides the external life of man from his internal and eternal roots. Now our time is up, so that's the foundation for the first evening.